Then he went through the way. Oh, I said. Crap. I just wanted to go have a nice lie down somewhere. Why was nothing ever simple? I stepped through the way and back into the mortal world, and almost instantly I felt better, lighter, more free. Gravity change. I wrenched my head back into the moment because I had to focus. Nicodemus might be rushing the way even now, as might a few million furious shades. I didn't think Hades would allow his prisoners to come flooding into the mortal world, but on the other hand, you never know with those types. At least wrecking the weaving of a spell was easier work than creating it. Michael, I said, cover me. He came to my side, sword in hand. I turned to the way, tired to my bones, lifted my staff and muttered, Disperdu, and a black shadow hurtled through the way, hitting me like a truck. I was watching for trouble and ready. Michael was ready. Either we were both wearier than we realized, or the shadow moved with such speed that neither of us had a chance to react, or both. The impact spun me around in a circle and dumped me on the ground with my everything hurting and my elbows tangled with my scapulae. I jerked my head up blearily, raising my arms in a defensive gesture to see that the streak of shadow had whooshed to the far end of Marcone's vault to its main door. Nicodemus rose up out of the swirl of shadow. He looked pale and awful, his eyes sunken with pain, but he held himself straight. His sword was sheathed again, and he still carried the Holy Grail negligently in one hand. Moving with obvious stiffness and pain, he twisted a handle that opened the main door of the vault from the inside. The door swung open when he pushed. Then he looked directly at me and quite calmly snapped the handle off at its base. Dresden, Nicodemus said. There was something furious and horrible in his eyes. I could see it even from there. From one father to another, he called. Well played. I felt my eyes widen. Stop him! I blurted and flung myself to my feet. Michael started running, gray, blurred toward the far end of the vault, moving at speeds one normally associates with low-flying aircraft. None of us got there in time to stop Nicodemus from letting out a harsh, bitter laugh and slamming the huge door closed. I ran to the other end of the vault anyway, or mostly ran, breathing hard. Anna Valmont stayed beside me, still carrying her tool roll. God, I said. I tried what was left of the handle, but couldn't get a grip on it. The vault door had locked, shutting us in. I slammed a shoulder against the door, but it wasn't moving, and I wasn't sure I could have blasted it open even if I'd been fresh. Michael, did you hear what he said? I heard, Michael said grimly. How could he know? You told him, Michael replied quietly. When you taunted him about Deirdre, you said things only another father would know to say. I let out a groan because Michael was right. Once Nicodemus had realized that I was a father, it was not too much of a stretch to identify the dark-haired, dark-eyed little girl who had suddenly appeared at Michael's house, a place that I knew damned well Nicodemus would surveil, even if he couldn't use his pet shadow to do it. And she had appeared there immediately after my insane assault on the Red Court and my apparent death to boot. It wasn't hard to figure. Nicodemus might not be able to walk onto Michael's property, but he had an entire dysfunctional posse of squires with assault rifles and shotguns who could, and he was filled with the pain of losing his daughter. Maggie was there. So were Michael's children. So was a defenseless archangel. He's going to your house, I breathed. He's going after our families. Chapter 48. Get back, Anna Valmont said sharply, and knelt to flick her tool roll open on the ground in front of the broken handle. Dresden, get out of my way. I moved aside and said, hurry, hurry, hurry. She started jerking tools out of the roll. I know. Hurry, I know. Can't you just cut it open? It's a vault door, Dresden, not a bicycle chain, Valmont snapped. She gave Michael an exasperated look and jerked her head toward me. Michael looked like he wanted to tell her to hurry too, but he said, let her work, Harry. Won't be long, she promised. Damn it, I said, dancing from one foot to the next. Dresden, Gray asked.
What?
A chorus of moaning wails echoed through the vault as if from a great distance. Gray pursed his lips. Should that way be standing open like that? I whipped my head around and stared at the way. The only light on the other side came from the way itself, but that was just enough to show me a huge figure step to the way. Its hairy kneecap was level with my sternum. Then it knelt down, and a huge, ugly humanoid face with a monobrow and one enormous eye in the center of its forehead peered hungrily at me. I gripped my staff and drew together my will. Just once I want something to go according to plan, I snarled.
Disperdurius!
Energy left me in a dizzying wave, and the outline of the way folded in on itself and vanished, taking the Cyclops with it. I turned from the collapsing way back to the vault door, even before the light show had finished playing out. There was a little phunt sound, followed by a hissing, and I turned to find Valmont holding a miniature welding torch of some kind, hooked to a pair of little tanks by rubber hoses. She passed a steel-shafted screwdriver to Gray and said,
I need an L-shape.
Gray grunted, took the thing in both hands, and narrowed his eyes. Then, with an abrupt movement and a blur in the shape of his forearms, he bent the screwdriver's shaft to a right angle.
Slide it inside the socket where he broke it off here, and hold it, she said.
Gray did. Valmont slid a strip of metal of some kind into the hole, held a little square of dark plastic up to protect her vision from the brilliant light of the torch, and sparks started to fly up from the door. She worked on it for about 500 years that probably fit inside a couple of minutes, and then the torch started running out of fuel and faltered.
Hold it still, she said. Okay, let go.
Gray released the screwdriver's handle, which now stuck out of the original fitting in approximately the same attitude as the original handle.
Do it. Let's go, I said. No, Valmont snapped. These materials aren't proper, and I'm none too sanguine about that braze. We've got to let it cool or you'll only break it off, and I haven't the fuel for a second try. 60 seconds.
Damn it, I said, pacing back and forth. Okay, when we get out, I'm heading for the house as fast as I can get there. Michael, I want you to get to a phone, and
I'm going with you, Michael said.
I turned to face him and said in a brutally flat, practical tone,
Your leg is hurt. You'll slow me down.
His jaw clenched. A muscle twitched, but he nodded.
And you'll need to help the others get clear of the bank, hopefully without getting shot to pieces on the way. Get clear, find a phone, and warn Charity. Maybe she'll have time to get them to the panic room.
He'll burn the house down around them, Michael said quietly.
Like hell he will, I said. Follow along as quick as you can.
He nodded. Then silently he offered me the hilt of Amorakius.
Can't take that from you, I said.
It's not mine, Harry, he said. I just kept it for a while. I put my fingers on the hilt and then shook my head and pushed it back toward him. The sword had tremendous power, but it had to be used with equally tremendous care, and I had neither the background nor the disposition for it. Murphy knew she shouldn't have been using Fidelacius, but last night she drew it anyway, and now it's gone. I'm no genius, but I learn eventually.
Michael smiled at me a little. You're a good man, Harry, but you're making the same mistake Nicodemus always has, and the same one Karen did.
What mistake?
You all think the critical word in the phrase sword of faith is sword.
I frowned at him.
The world always thinks that the destruction of a physical vessel is victory, he said quietly. But the Savior was more than merely cells and tissue and chemical compounds, and Fidelacius is more than wood and steel.
It's gone, Michael, I said quietly.
Sometimes the bad guys win one.
Sometimes they seem to, but only for a time.
How can you know that?
I can't know, he said, his face lighting with a sudden smile. That's why they call it faith, Harry. You'll see.
Gray, I noticed, was staring at Michael intently.
Time, Valmont said.
She reached up and braced the shaft of the screwdriver with her fingers. Then, very gently, she turned the handle. The vault door let out a heavy click and swung open.
Let's get moving, I said.
Assuming Banda lets us, Gray added. We pushed out of the vault and into the secure room and found the place absolutely wrecked. The exterior of the vault had been pocked with dents half an inch deep. More dents and smears covered the security boxes on the other two walls. The wall that had contained the mines was simply gone, bared to the concrete beneath, and that had been chewed and mangled by ricocheting ball bearings, some of which were still visible, buried in the wall. The floor was covered in gravel and debris. Also, 30 of Binder's goons were in formation around the vault door, covering every possible angle. They were all pointing Uzis at us.
Whoa, I said, gripping my staff. Binder, wait. Move another inch in your slurry, came Binder's voice from the hallway outside the security room.
By some minor miracle, the door was still on its hinges, and the little mercenary was staying out of sight behind it.
Where's Hannah?
My first instinct was to say Binder's partner was coming along right behind us, but something told me that would be a bad idea, so I swallowed and said,
Dead.
There was a moment of silence, then Binder's voice came back, roughened.
What happened?
She forgot rule number one, I said. She took one of the coins. I didn't have a choice.
Didn't have a choice. You White Council boys say that a lot, Binder said in a very mild tone that sounded infinitely more frightening than a harsh one would have been.
Nicodemus says your crew betrayed us, killed Deidre, Hannah, and the big monkey, and that you're keeping all the loot.
He told you some of the truth, I said, but he's lying about who tried to stick the knife in first. We played it straight. He turned on us. Part of Binder's face appeared from behind the door, and he grunted. Then he jerked his chin at Michael and said,
Sir Knight, is that what happened?
Your partner took the coin of Lashiel, Michael said firmly. Nicodemus murdered his own daughter to open the gate of blood. Once we were inside, he ordered Miss Asher and the Janosqua to turn on the rest of us. We fought. They lost. Binder squinted at Gray, a disapproving scowl coming over his features.
You turned your coat, then?
Dresden contracted me before Nicodemus did. I did what he hired me to do.
Binder lifted an eyebrow.
Ah, that explains it.
Gray shrugged.
Hannah, Binder said, his eye going back to me. You killed her?
I did, I said. I offered to let her back down. She wouldn't. I'm sorry. She was too strong to handle any other way. Binder spat a quiet, vicious oath and looked away.
Stupid kid.
Not a bad partner, but not a scrap of sense.
Just curious, Gray said. You gonna shoot us or what?
Aye?
Binder said. Then he glanced at the goons and they lowered their weapons and began filing back out.
No. The lads ran out of ammunition at least 20 minutes ago. It was hand to hand after that. But then the coppers started to arrive, and Marcone's people backed off to think about things for a bit.
More like to get the Einherjar jar in his backup, I muttered. Binder's goons were formidable, but they weren't going to be able to stand up to a crew of genuine Norsemen with a dozen centuries of experience each, who hadn't been impressed by death the first time around.
What's the status out there?
Binder's eyes seemed to glaze over for a moment. Then he reported,
A dozen patrol cars are blocked off the area. Some fire trucks are here. Parts of the building above us are on fire. There's a million more vehicles on the way, one presumes, but the streets are one big sheet of ice, and for now the cops are just covering the exits. The weather's turned foul. There's a heavy fog coming off the lake.
Ice and fog, I said. I like it.
Sun's not up yet, Binder said, and some evil, handsome old bloke hexed all the streetlights and spotlights out. We get out of here now, we might do it in one piece.
What happened to Nicodemus? Michael asked.
He flew out, Binder spat. Told me you'd killed Hannah and left me to rot.
I grunted.
The bit about the money, Binder asked. How true is that?
We've got one backpack, Belmont said quietly. Small stones, easy to move.
We'll have to split it once we're all clear.
I blinked and looked at her. She gave me a calm, indecipherable look.
All for one, she said. I want out of this, too.
She was right. I was nearing the end of my rope. Binder looked exhausted as well. If we just ran out the door all willy-nilly, pure chance would decide our fates. Dark or not, foggy or not, Chicago patrol cops were heavily armed, and given the gunfire and explosions and so forth, they had to think that this was some kind of terrorist attack in progress. They'd shoot first, and second, and third, and fourth, and ask questions to fill the time while they reloaded. Some buckshot through the skull would not improve my response time to the attack on the carpenter's house, and I owed Valmont and Michael a lot more than to let them get shot whilst fleeing the scene of a crime. More than anything, I wanted to be moving toward Michael's home, but to do that, I had to get us out of the building in one piece first. The only way to do that was to work together. Binder, I said, Nicodemus screwed us all. But I'm offering you a new deal, right here, a mutual survival pact. We split the pack evenly between the five of us once we're out of here. They aren't red ones, but 20% of them are yours if you sign on with us to get us all the hell out of here. Your word on it?
My word, I said.
Dunno, Binder said, seeing as how you didn't follow through on the promise to kill me if you saw me here again. I glowered.
Tonight, Binder asked, will you give your word?
You have it, Michael said.
Are you in or not? I asked.
Binder regarded Michael for a moment, then nodded once.
Course I'm in. What choice do I have?
Everyone else? There was a general murmur of agreement. Right then, listen up, I said, feeling the urge to go sprinting after Nicodemus in every fiber of my body. But I used my head. First things first. Get out of the death trap we were in, then save Maggie from hers. Here's the plan.
Chapter 49. The plan didn't take long to put into effect. Binder's goons poured out of all sides of the bank building in a howling horde, crashing through windows and sprinting through doorways. They ran straight into gunfire from 24 patrol cars surrounding the place. Binder's goons died hard, but die they did after taking several rounds each. They leapt onto cars. They waved their arms threateningly. They brandished their empty Uzis with malicious intent. But they didn't actually hurt anybody. Binder's share was forfeit if they had. And when they went down, they splattered back into the ectoplasm they'd been formed from in the first place. A clear, gelatinous goo that would rapidly evaporate, leaving nothing behind but empty Uzis and confusion. Most of the goons went out the west side of the building. Our little crew went out several seconds behind them, covered in my best veil, which is to say, looking slightly blurrier and more translucent than we would have normally appeared. Veils aren't really my thing, all right, especially not covering that many people all at once. In that light, in that weather, in the howling confusion of an apparent assault by demons of corporate dress code, my paltry veil was enough. I took the lead, Michael brought up the rear, and we all held hands in a chain, like a group of school children traveling from one place to another. We had to. The veil would only have covered me otherwise. Outside the ring of police cars was a perimeter of other emergency vehicles, fire trucks and ambulances and the like, parked on whatever uneven slough they had managed on the ice. The press had begun to arrive, while an insufficient number of other cops tried to cordon off the block around the Capristi building. Every single person there was straining to see through the fog to get an idea of what was happening during the howling chaos of the attack and the subsequent hail of gunfire. I kept the veil around us as we hobbled through the confusion at Michael's best pace. It didn't stop people from noticing that someone was hurrying by, but at least it would prevent anyone from identifying us. Michael's bad leg lasted for another block, and then he dropped out of the chain, gasping, to stumble to a halt and lean against a building. Once his grip was broken, my veil faltered and fell apart, and the five of us flickered fully back into sight. Right, I said. You three keep moving, fast as you can, before Marcone's people twig to what's going on. Find a phone soonest.
We should split up, as quick as may be, Binder said.
He looked pale and shaken. He'd been born in an age before the invention of cardio, and he'd been summoning demons all night. Valmont added a firm, silent nod to Binder's opinion.
When you're doing crime, listen to the crime pros, I said. Take your share and give Michael what's left.
God go with you, Harry, Michael said.
Gray, I said, with me.
And I turned, called upon Winter, and started running. It took several seconds for Gray to catch up with me, but he did so easily enough. Then he let out an impatient sound and said,
Try not to clench up.
What?
I blurted.
Parkour,
he said impatiently, and he caught me by the waist and flung me into the air. I went up, flailing my arms and legs, and looked down to see something that was basically impossible. Gray smoothly dropped to all fours, blurred, and suddenly there was a large, long-legged gray horse running beneath me, and I came down on his back. I managed to angle it to minimize the critical impact zone, catching most of my weight on my thighs, but doing so nearly sent me tumbling off, and I had to flail pretty wildly to hang on. I did it, though, and set myself. I hadn't ridden a horse since my days on Ebenezer's farm down in the Ozarks, but I'd done it every day down there, and the muscle memory was still in place. Riding a running horse bareback isn't easy when you're feeling a little croggled from seeing someone completely ignore the laws of physics and magic as you know them. Shapeshifting I can deal with, but Gray had done something more significant than that. He'd altered his freaking mass. Rearranging a body with magic, sure, I basically knew how that worked. You just move things around, but the mass always remained the same. Granted, I'd seen Ursiel shift into his bear form and add oodles of mass, so I knew it could be done somehow. But I figured that was maybe a fallen angel thing. Though that didn't make sense either. I'd seen Listens to Wind reduce his mass pretty significantly in a shape-shifting war with a Negloshi, but I'd figured he had managed to make some materials denser and heavier, crowding the same mass into a smaller area. Gray hadn't just made himself bigger. He'd made himself 7 or 8 times bigger, and done it as quick as blinking. My pounding head was making it hard for the thoughts to get through, but I got my staff tucked under my arm so that I could hold onto the horse's mane with the fingers of my good hand and realize that I was babbling them aloud.
Oh, I heard myself realize, ectoplasm. You bring in the mass the same way Binder's goons make some for themselves.
Gray snorted as if I'd stated the very obvious, and then he shook his head and started running. When I'm running with Winter on me, I can move pretty fast as any human being can manage, and I can do it longer. Call it 25 or 30 miles an hour. A thoroughbred horse runs a race at about 35. Quarter horses have been clocked at 55 miles an hour or so over short distances. Gray started moving at quarter horse speed, maybe faster, and he didn't stop. I just tried to hang on. The ice storm had brought Chicago to a relative standstill, but there were still some cars out moving, a few people on the sidewalks. Gray had to weave through them, as none of them were fast enough to get out of the way by their own volition. By the time they could see Gray moving toward them through the fog, it was too late for them to avoid him, and there was very little I could do but hang on and try not to fall off. At the pace Gray was moving, a tumble would be more like a car wreck than anything else, only I wouldn't have the protection of, you know, a car around me when it happened. The experience gave me a new appreciation for Karen and her Harley, except that her Harley didn't freaking jump over mailboxes, pedestrians, and one of those itty-bitty electric cars when they got in its way. I noticed somewhere along the line that Gray was as subject as anyone else to the slippery ice on the streets and sidewalks of the town. At some points, he was more skating than running, though he seemed to handle it all with remarkable grace. If it wouldn't have reduced my odds of surviving the ride, I'd have closed my eyes. We were moving in the right direction, and it didn't occur to me until we were nearly there that I'd never told Gray where to find Michael's house. By the time we got there, Gray was breathing like a steam engine, and the hide beneath me was coated with sweat and lather and burning hot. His wide, flared nostrils were flecked with blood. As remarkable as he was, moving that much mass that quickly for that long apparently had a metabolic cost that not even Gray could escape. We thundered past Karen's little SUV, still stuck where she'd crashed it yesterday evening. And it was as he tried to turn down Michael Street that Gray's agility met his exhaustion and faltered. He hit a patch of ice, and we went sideways toward the house on the corner. I felt his weight leave the ground, and we started to tumble in midair. It was going to be an ugly one. Most of a ton of horse and about 250 pounds of wizard were going to bounce along the frozen earth together and smash into a building, and there wasn't a whole hell of a lot I could do about it. Except that it didn't happen that way. As we tumbled, the horse blurred, and suddenly Gray was back, along with a great, slobbering heap of steaming ectoplasm. He grabbed me in midair, pulling my shoulders back hard against his torso. And when we first hit the ground, his body cushioned the shock of impact, taking it on his back instead of on my skull. We bounced, and it hurt, spun wildly once, and then slammed into the side of the house about a quarter of a second after all the ectoplasmic goo. Again, Gray took the impact on his body, sparing mine, and I heard bones snapping as he did. Between him, some thick bushes at the base of the house, and the cushion of slime, I came to a bone-jarring but non-fatal halt. I pushed myself up and checked on Gray. He was lying in a heap, his eyes closed, his nose and mouth bloody, but still breathing. His chest was grotesquely misshapen, but even as I watched, he inhaled and a couple of ribs seemed to expand back toward a more natural shape. Hell's bells, that guy could take a beating. And that was me saying that.
"The things I do," he rasped, "for rent money."
I lifted my head blearily to see the big unmarked vans Nicodemus had used for transport at the start of the job turn the corner at the other end of the street and lumber slowly toward Michael's house. Gray had gotten me there in time, if only barely. Of course, now that I was here, the question was what I was going to do about it. I stood up, calling my veil about myself again. It might not accomplish much, but at least it didn't take a lot of energy to do it, and I started moving quietly toward the enemy. The winter night's feet were absolutely soundless on the ice. My head was killing me, a steady pounding. My arm ditto, even through the insulation offered by the winter mantle. Fatigue and hard use had tied knots in my back, and I didn't know how many more spells I could pull off before I fell over, if any. So why, I asked myself, was I walking toward the vans, preparing for a fight? I blamed the winter mantle, which continually pushed at my inner predator, edging me on to fight, hunt, and kill my way to a solution. There was a time and a place for that kind of thing, but as I watched the vans begin to slow carefully on the icy streets, my sanity told me that it wasn't here or now. I might be able to drop an explosive fire spell on the vans, but explosions are hardly ever as neat and as thorough as the people who create them hope for, and the effort might just drop me unconscious onto the sleet-coated ground. I could lie there senseless while the survivors murdered my daughter. Too many variables. Why duke it out with the bad guys when maybe I could grab the carpenters and Maggie and slip out ahead of them? So instead of starting a rumble, I kept the veil up and sprinted around the house on the corner and started leaping fences, moving through backyards to the carpenter house. I came up to the back door and tried the doorknob. It didn't move, and I risked a light rap on the glass of the storm door.
"Charity,"
I said in a hushed, urgent tone.
"Charity, it's me."
I checked the corners of the house, in case the squires had deployed people on foot to move through the backyards the way I had. And when I looked back to the storm door, the heavy security door beyond it had been opened and the twin barrels of a coach gun gaped in front of my eyes. I dropped my veil in a hurry and held up my hands. I think I said something clever like, "Glurk." Charity lowered the shotgun, her blue eyes wide. She was wearing pajamas and one of her handmade tactical coats over them. A layer of titanium mail between two multi-layered coats of anti-ballistic fabric. She had what looked like a Colt Model 1911 in a holster on her hip.
"Harry,"
she said, and hurriedly opened the storm door. I hurried in and said,
"They're coming."
"Michael just called," she said, nodding and shutting the security door behind me, throwing multiple bolts closed as she did.
"Where are the kids?"
"Upstairs in the panic room."
"We've got to get them out," I said.
"Too late," said a voice from the front room. "They're here."
I padded forward intently and found Waldo Butters crouching by the front windows, staring out. He was wearing his Batman vest with all its magical gadgets and holding a pump-action shotgun carefully, as if he knew how to use it, but only just. In the doorway to the kitchen stood Uriel. He was wearing an apron. There was what appeared to be pancake flour staining his shirt. Instead of looking dangerous and absolute the way an archangel should, he looked slender and a little tired and vulnerable. He didn't have a gun, but he stood holding a long kitchen knife in competent hands, and there was a quiet balance to his body that would have warned me that he might be dangerous if I hadn't known him. Mouse sat next to Uriel, looking extremely serious. His tail thumped twice against the vulnerable archangel's legs as he saw me. Charity began when she saw Uriel. Darn it, she continued, her voice annoyed. You're supposed to be upstairs with the children. I was fighting wars when this planet was nothing but expanding gases, Uriel said. You also didn't leak and die if someone poked a hole in you, I said. The angel frowned. I can help. Help what? I asked him, drawing the monster revolver from my duster pocket. Slice up bananas for pancakes? This is a gunfight. Harry, Butters said urgently. I said in frustration and went to Butters. Mouse, stay with him, boy. Woof, Mouse said seriously. That was obviously the mutt's plan, but I read somewhere that a good commander never gives an order he knows won't be obeyed. It therefore stood to reason that he might as well give orders that he knows will be obeyed whenever possible. Kill the lights, I said to Charity. She nodded. Most of the lights were already out, but a few nightlights that could double as detachable flashlights glowed in power outlets here and there. She went around detaching them, and the interior of the home became darker than the pre-dawn winter light outside. I moved to Butters' side and peered out through the translucent drapes while I reloaded my big revolver. I could dimly see Squires unloading from the two vans now parked in front of the house. They carried shotguns and rifles, as they had before. 9, Butters said quietly, counting gunmen. 10, 11, Jesus. Keep counting, I said. It might matter. Butters nodded. 14, 15, 16? 16. Stay down, I told everyone. Stay away from the windows. Don't let them know anything. Someone moved through the dark and crouched quietly next to me. I called the police already, Charity said. They're responding to a big emergency, I replied. Be a while before they get here. I noted 2 pairs of gunmen splitting off from the others, heading around either side of the house. They're going around. I'll take the back, Charity said. You know how to use guns too, huh? I asked her. I saw her teeth gleam in the dimness. I like hammers and axes better. We'll know in a minute. Luck, I said, and she vanished back into the rear of the house. Michael's house had been fortified the same way mine had been, with heavy-duty security doors that would resist anything short of breaching charges or the determined use of a ram. With anything like a little luck, they might try the doors, find them tough, and waste some time figuring it out. But Nicodemus didn't leave room for luck in his plans. 8 men started carefully toward the front door over the lawn. 2 of them were carrying small charges of plastic explosives. Of course, he'd already scoped the place out. Or maybe he just planned to blow the door off its hinges, even if it was made of painted paper. Damn it, I wasn't a soldier. I didn't have the training and the whole tactical thing. But if it was me and I wanted to get inside a house where I expected at least a little bit of fight, it might be smart to go in from 2 directions at once. Maybe I'd have most of my guys coming from the front, and just a few from the back, to reduce the chances of them massacring one another by mistake. For that matter, maybe I'd just put a few guys on the back door to plug anyone who tried to run away. Of course, the whole point of breaching a room is to do it when you aren't expected, and they were. That gave us at least a little advantage, right? Sure it did. They're going to blow the door, I said to Butters. And maybe toss in a few flashbangs, and then they'll roll in here and start shooting. Get over there behind the couch and wait for them. Soon as that door opens, start shooting through it. Butters swallowed and nodded in a jerky motion. His face was pale and beaded with cold sweat.
Right.
He crawled over to the couch. Meanwhile, I went to the wall beside the staircase that went upstairs. When the door blew, it would slam open, or if it got taken off the hinges, fly back onto the staircase. I would crouch beside the staircase, where most of my body would be hidden, except for my gun arm and my head. I got into position and put the gun down on the floor, where I could find it easily. Then I waited. 10 seconds later, there was a sound like a huge hammer hitting a flat rock, and a sensation like standing in surf and being hit in the chest with a wave, only less substantial. The door flew open. I could barely get the air out of my chest, but I flicked my hand at the door and muttered,
"Venda servitas."
A gust of powerful wind hit the doorway from my side, just as several objects tumbled in from the other side, and they fell back to the porch with dull thumps before there was a wash of light and sound that would have obliterated my vision if I hadn't already shielded my eyes with my hand. A couple of wordless cries of confusion went up from the squires outside, and exhaustion from the effort made my vision narrow to a tunnel. I saw someone move in the doorway, and then Butters opened up with a shotgun. I grabbed my pistol, aimed it at the doorway, and fired 2 rounds as quickly as I could aim them. A man was knocked down, and while I'd like to claim credit for being an awesome gunslinger, odds were better that it was Butters and his shotgun who were responsible. There wasn't time for anything more than that. Fanatics they might be, but they weren't stupid. It took them less than a couple of seconds to clear away from the porch and our lines of fire. Even the guy who went down scrabbled away, leaving a smear of blood behind him as he did. I stopped shooting, frustrated at the lack of targets, but Butters kept pumping shell after shell into the empty doorway. He didn't stop until the shotgun clicked on an empty chamber 3 or 4 times. I darted a look at him to find him staring at the doorway, trembling visibly, his face pale as a sheet.
"Dude," I said, "reload."
He stared at me with goggle eyes for a second, then jerked his head in a nod and started fumbling at one of his pockets. I waited until he had the shotgun reloaded and said,
"Cover the door. I'm going to check on Charity." "Right," he said.
I turned and paced toward the back of the house, trying to remember where the walls were so that I didn't walk into them. And as I rounded the corner, nearly walked into a squire with a shotgun. No time to think. I swept my staff from left to right, knocking it against the shotgun. The weakened grip of my left hand didn't give me a lot of leverage, but when fire and thunder bloomed from the barrel, instead of dying, I reeled in sudden agony at the pain of the sound so near my eardrum, so it was enough. The squire knocked the staff from my weak grip with a slash of the shotgun's barrel. I shot him twice in the stomach with my big revolver. He let out a gasp and went down, and I kicked the shotgun out of his hands as he fell. Behind him, his partner drew a bead on me with an assault carbine and had me dead to rights. Terror spiked through me. I tried to fling myself away, knowing, as I did, that it wouldn't do me any good. Uriel melted out of the shadows behind the second squire with his kitchen knife and opened both of the squire's big arteries and his windpipe with a single slice. The man collapsed, and Uriel rode him to the floor, pinning the assault rifle down with one hand for a few seconds, until the squire stopped struggling. He looked up at me, his expression sickened. I stared at the 2 squires. They'd come in the back.
Charity.
By the time I got to the back door, it was standing open, one side of it twisted and blackened with the force of the breaching charge that had opened it. Charity's shotgun lay on the floor, a couple of expended flashbangs next to it. There was a smear of blood and a trail, leading to the door and out into the ice. Charity was gone. It wasn't hard to figure. The bad guys had blown the back door, only she hadn't had a wizard there to stop the flashbangs. They sailed in, stunned her, and she'd been taken before she could fire a shot. I saw a flash of movement outside the door and leapt back as another shotgun roared. The squire missed me, but not by much, and a section of drywall the size of my fist vanished from the wall behind where I'd been.
"Harry!"
Butters howled. I hurried back to the front of the house to find Butters staring out through the curtains, his expression twisted up in horror. Nicodemus was standing on the sidewalk outside the carpenter house, his shadow writhing.
"T
Tessa stood beside him in human form, wearing black trousers and a black shirt. Her expression was distant, haunted. She looked awful, thin and wasted away, like those movies of people rescued from concentration camps. But her eyes burned with some dark emotion that the word hate didn't begin to cover. As I watched, two squires half-dragged, half-carried Charity over to him. They dumped her on the sidewalk in front of Nicodemus. She seemed stunned. Her leg was covered in blood. The armored coat was chewed and torn over her wounded thigh, where most of the shotgun pellets had been caught and stopped. Nicodemus seized a handful of Charity's hair and dragged her face up to where she could see her house. My heart twisted and rage filled me. I knew what he was doing. Nicodemus planned to leave a message for Michael. It wasn't enough for Nicodemus simply to kill the knight's children, not when he could kill them and leave Charity's corpse behind in such a fashion as to make clear that she had been forced to watch them die first.
"Watch, Mrs. Carpenter," Tessa hissed. "Watch!"
Nicodemus turned his head toward three squires who were standing by with bottles of vodka fitted into Molotov cocktails with bits of cloth. The bottles were already lit. His gravelly voice came out low and hard.
"Burn it down."
Chapter 50. I stepped up to the door with my staff in hand, just as the three men hurled the bottles of vodka, pointed the staff, and snarled,
"Enfriga!"
Icy air screamed. The bottles soared up toward the house and hit the roof with a number of dull thunks, then came rattling back down to fall to the lawn, glass cracking, their contents frozen solid. A number of things happened all at once. Tessa let out a hellish screech. She lifted a hand toward me, gathering power in her palm. But as she released it, Nicodemus seized her arm and directed the blast straight up into the air. Squires started shooting at me. A bullet smacked into my duster over my left lung and hit me like a fist, spinning me to one side. Mouse hurtled toward the rear of the house. And as I fell, Mab's earring burst, the two pieces flying out of my ear in different directions and bouncing off the walls of the entry hall, and all the pain in the universe came crashing down on me at the same time. Dimly, I heard Butters calling my name. Bullets hit the entry hall and the doorway and darted past me in spiteful, hissing whispers to thwack into the stairs behind me. I lay there in a stupor of pain, and another round hit my duster again, and then Butters was hauling me out of the doorway by main force. I tried to care about other things that were happening, but mostly I was trying to work up enough energy to curl up into a defensive fetal position, and failing.
"Harry!"
Butters screamed, propping me up.
"Harry, get up! They're coming back!"
"Burn it!"
Tessa shrieked.
"Burn them! Burn them all!"
"Harry!"
Butters howled.
"Do something!"
I didn't have enough energy left in me to contort my face.
"Oh, God,"
Butters said.
"Oh, God, oh, God, oh, God."
And that was when I saw Waldo Butters choose to be a hero. He looked up the stairs toward where the children were hidden. Then he looked out toward the men outside. Then he hardened his jaw. And with businesslike motions, he stripped me out of my leather duster. He put it on. The sleeves were too long, and it was grotesquely oversized, but I had to admit that he got a lot more coverage out of the thing than I ever did. "Bob," he said. Glowing lights surged up out of one of the pouches on his Batman vest, dancing nervously in the slowly growing light of dawn.
"Yeah, boss?"
"We're going in." "If anything happens to me," he said, "I want you to head back to the skull. Tell Andy everything you saw. Tell her I said to get you to someone responsible. And tell her that I said that I loved her, okay?"
"Boss?"
Bob said, his voice subdued.
"You sure about this?"
"There's nobody else here," Butters said quietly. "Harry's down. Charity's been captured. We can't risk Uriel's demise. And if we wait for help, they'll burn the kids to death while we wring our hands."
"But you aren't up for this. You can't possibly beat them."
Gotta try, Butters said.
You'll die trying, Bob said, and it won't make any difference.
I've got to believe that it will, he said. Maybe I can slow them down until some real help gets here.
Oh,
Bob said, his voice very small. You ready? Butters asked. Can you access the duster?
Sure, I tutored Harry on these spells. Keep the bullets off me for as long as you can, Butters said.
Got it, Bob said. Let's give him hell, boss.
That's the spirit, Butters said.
He took a deep breath and then put his hand on my shoulder and said, Don't worry, Harry. You've done enough. I got this. I wanted to scream at Butters not to go, not to throw his life away, to go get the kids and try to run. It would have been just as hopeless, but he might not realize that. And at least they'd die with bullets in them instead of being burned to death. But I couldn't move, or think, or do anything else. The pain was simply too great. It wasn't a headache now. It was a world ache. I didn't have a broken arm anymore. I didn't have a body at all. I just had pain. But I started crying as Waldo Butters stood up, rolled the sleeves of my duster up until his hands could reach out of them, grabbed a couple of things from his vest, flung something on the floor of the porch, and went out the door. The first globe he'd hurled down released a sudden, brief cloud of opaque smoke that went roiling out in all directions, and guns began firing outside. No, damn it. No. I couldn't let things end like this. Butters was a friend, and too good a man to let die while I lay on the floor, unable to go to his aid. I fought to rise, but my arms and legs couldn't hear me through the pain. Again I struggled, throwing up every mental shield I could against the agony, and this time I managed to shift my weight and fall heavily onto my side. My cheek lay on the floor, and I found myself staring along it, down the hall toward the back of the house, past the dining room where I'd struggled with the squires who invaded, and where the remnants of Fidelacius had been carefully set on the dining room table. The table had been jarred in the fight. The broken hilt of the Sword of Faith had fallen and rolled toward the front of the house. It was only a few feet away from me. Could it be? When the knights of the Blackened Denarius set out to wreak harm, the swords were there to oppose them. The Sword of Faith was no more. But that did not mean that the power that guided the swords could not find another means of expressing itself. I'd seen Charity Carpenter rely upon her faith when Molly was in danger before. How much deeper would it be now, with her home and family in peril? Maybe Michael was right about the sword. If he was, there was still a chance. And I had to believe that. People I loved were going to die. I had to believe that there was hope. Hope lets you do things you would otherwise never be able to do, gives strength when everything is darkest. In that moment, maybe it helped me, because I forced my nerve endings to respond and drag myself toward the hilt of the sword, clenching my teeth in sheer defiance of the agony supplanting my existence. It felt like it took forever before my fingers settled on the wooden grip of the sword, but by the time I finally reached it and turned back to the door, Butters had only at that moment reached the front gate. My duster whirled and swirled around him like a living thing, orange light playing along the normally invisible black runes I'd tattooed into the leather, the mantle flaring up wildly like a cobra's hood. Half a dozen squires stood stupefied and confused in dissipating clouds of memory mist, and of the others that were moving, only one had a clean shot at Butters. But the little guy's hand pointed, and an orange flicker danced out, a thin line wrapping around the barrel of the gunman's weapon and holding fast. Butters heaved, shouting, and hauled the rifle out of the man's hands. The cord released the gun in a glitter of orange light and slithered back up Butters' sleeve. And then, before any of the scrambling gunmen could get a clear shot at him, Butters hurtled the carpenter's little fence and smashed into Tessa in a tackle which, if not exactly physically impressive, was dynamic as hell. The impact tore the pint-sized Tessa loose from Charity, and the emaciated Denarian let out a furious squall and went down under Butters' weight. Nicodemus drew his sword and thrust it at Butters' back, but the flying folds of my leather duster slapped the blade aside. Butters wasn't much of a fighter, but he was game. He screamed and slammed his head down into Tessa's.
Then she lifted her hand and shouted something, and there was a crash of sound, a flash of light. Butters flew off of her and landed 6 feet away, sprawled and dazed on the icy street. I could see blood running from one of his ears. He made a vague, spreading gesture with one hand, and Bob's trail of campfire sparks emerged from the duster and soared away in the general direction of Butters' apartment.
"What was that?"
Tessa demanded, her tone furious as she came back to her feet.
"A detail," Nicodemus said, his tone harsh. "Stupid, but brave little man. Nice try."
He stepped over to Butters and raised his sword. Butters clenched his jaw and raised his hand in a hopeless, defensive gesture. He knew what was coming, what had to come. But though his face was ghostly white, his eyes were steady, unflinching. He'd made his choice, and he would accept the consequences of his actions. And for that moment, everyone out there was looking at Nicodemus and Butters, and no one was looking at Michael Carpenter's wife. Hope gave me a last burst of strength.
"Charity!"
I croaked. Her head snapped around toward me, and she blinked in my direction. I threw the broken hilt of Philoceus as hard as I could. There are moments in your life that, when you look back at them, you realize were perfect. 100 million things had to happen to all come together at the same time for such moments to come into existence. So many things that it beggars imagination to think that they could possibly have happened by random chance. This was one of them. The broken hilt of the sword tumbled in a perfect arc. It flew up, soared down, and cleared the little fence in the front yard by maybe an inch. The rotation of its length was as precise as a juggler's throw, setting the hilt to tumble directly into Charity's palm. But she bobbled it and missed the grab. The wooden hilt, with its lonely, harmless little fragment of the sword's blade, bounced off the icy sidewalk and up into the air. It tumbled several more times, clipped Nicodemus's shoulder, and landed directly in Waldo Butters's upraised hand. His fingers closed around the grip of the broken sword of faith, and if I hadn't seen it with my own eyes, I would scarcely have believed what happened. There was a flash of light. There was a sound like a howl of holy trumpets backed up by the voices of an entire choir. And suddenly a shaft of blinding silver-white light 3 feet long sprang from the broken hilt of Philoceus and shone in the first golden light of that day's dawn, humming with the full power of the sword, only louder now, more melodic, and physically audible. Nicodemus's sword was already falling, and when it met the blade of light, there was a shriek of protesting metal, a flash of sparks, and he reeled back 3 quick steps, staring at his own weapon in incomprehension. Philoceus had sheared it off as neatly as if it had been paper instead of steel. The severed end of Nicodemus's sword glowed white hot.
"Ah," said a voice next to me, in a tone of intense satisfaction, and I jerked a quick glance up to see Uriel crouching next to me, his teeth showing, his eyes glittering. Butters came to his feet, and his jaw hung open. He stared at the humming blade in his hands for a second, and then suddenly his teeth showed in a joyous smile that was no less fierce for being so, and his eyes locked on Nicodemus. Suddenly there was an incoherent scream from behind one of the vans, and the vehicle rocked as if something enormous had smashed against it. A second later, Mouse stepped out from behind the van, where its bulk was shielding him from the immediate aim of the slowly recovering squires. The foo dog's head was low, his body crouched and tensed, hackles raised, gleaming, sharp, freshly bloodied teeth bared. He was no more than a few feet from Nicodemus's back, and at his appearance, Anduriel's shadow form went berserk, flickering and twisting in a dozen directions at once, like a panicked animal running to the ends of its tether.
"Nice try," Butters said. "Mister, where I come from, there is no try."
And he lifted the sword to a guard position and charged, coat flaring dramatically, impossibly. Mouse let out a great coughing roar of a bark and flung himself forward,
silver-blue light gathering in his fur and around his mane and jaws. I saw the fury and the rage and bafflement in Nicodemus's face as the newly minted Sir Butters came toward him, and I saw something else there too. Fear. The furious light of the Sword of Faith renewed filled him with terror. He let out a cry of frustration and leapt into the air, where Anduril's shadow gathered around him in a sudden blob of fluid darkness, and then streaked away up into the dawn-lit fog and was gone. Butters whirled at once toward Tessa, but the other Denarian had already fled into the fog, leaving behind a frustrated cry that turned into her demon form's brassy shriek as it faded. Butters, with Mouse at his side, turned to face the squires who still remained. The nearest one, I saw, was Jordan, who clutched his shotgun in white-knuckled hands, his expression bewildered. In fact, as I looked around, I saw the same expression on the faces of every squire there. Utter confusion, as if they just beheld something that they knew damn well was impossible. They'd just seen their unbeatable lord and master humbled and forced to flee by a pipsqueak of a knight who wore black-rimmed spectacles and might have weighed 120 pounds, soaking wet. "It's over," Butters said. Fidelacius's ominous hum gave his voice a certain terrifying punctuation. "We make an end of it, right here. It's over, guys." Jordan, his eyes welling with tears, dropped his arms to his side, abruptly, limply, like an exhausted child. His weapon tumbled to the ground, and over the next few seconds the others did exactly the same. The Sword of Faith, I thought, cuts both ways. I realized my cheek was back against the floor a moment later, and dully noted that my eyes had stopped working at some point. They were open, but they weren't showing me any images. Maybe that's what they meant by the phrase, lazy eye. I'm hysterical when I'm dying. I heard a sound then, a distant howl of northern wind, rapidly growing louder in pitch and volume. "Easy, Harry," said Uriel's voice in the blackness. "Molly's here. Easy." And then I went away. Chapter 51. I woke up in bed. There was a colorful cartoon pony on the ceiling above me. My body ached. I mean, it ached to no end. Just breathing felt like a motion that stretched sore muscles. I was hideously thirsty and ravenous, and considering the complaints from my bladder, I'd been down for a while. I looked around without moving my head. I was in Maggie's room. Judging from the amber sunshine coming in through the window and covering one wall, it was evening. I wondered if it was the same day. Maggie's raised bed towered over me, and I realized that I was on a mattress laid on the floor of her room. Something heavy was on one of my feet, and it had gone to sleep. I moved my head enough to see what it was and wished I hadn't done that. My skull pounded like a little man was slamming it with a hammer. I winced and focused my eyes through the discomfort. Mouse slept on the floor beside the bed, and his massive chin rested on my ankle. His ears were twitching, though his eyes were closed, his breathing steady.
"Hey," I croaked. "Gonna lose my foot, you keep that up. Fall right off."
Mouse snorted and lifted his head. He blinked blearily for a second, as any reasonable person does upon waking, and then dropped his mouth open in a doggy grin. His tail started wagging, and he rose so that he could walk to my head and start giving me slobbery dog kisses while making little happy sounds. "Ack," I said. I waved my hands without any real enthusiasm and settled for scratching him under the chin and behind the ears while he greeted me.
"Easy there, super dog," I said. "I think I exfoliated a couple of licks ago."
Mouse made a happy chuffing sound, tail still wagging. Then he turned and padded out of the bedroom. A moment later he returned and Molly followed him in. She made an impression walking into the room. I was used to Molly in old jeans and sandals and a faded t-shirt. Now she wore slacks and a deep blue blouse that looked like they'd been hand-tailored to fit. Her hair, which I'd seen in every improbable shade and configuration imaginable, was now long and straight in the color of moonlight on corn silk. She still looked a shade too angular and thin,